Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are. People of color in restaurants and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
What's the first original piece of food tech? Find out on this episode of Tech Bites. Hello, hello, Heritage Radio Network listeners tuning in from 150 countries around the world, about a million listens a month. Tuning in to shows like this one, Tech Bites, where every Thursday at 11 a.m. we talk to innovators and influencers in the food tech space. And today, my guest seat is occupied by one of my unindicted co-conspirator co-hosts, Harry Rosenblum, who is the host of Feast Your Ears, which is live on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. And I'm really looking forward to this show. I like to have other Heritage Radio hosts on, so it becomes a little bit of a family affair. And this episode, actually, the spark of inspiration came from Harry's 100th episode, which was about a month ago, which is an amazing accomplishment, doing 100 shows. And we were talking on the show. He asked a question of what I thought the first piece of technology was. And it was such a great conversation that we had to sort of give it its own space and time. So, Harry, thank you for not only asking me onto your show, but that the gift that keeps on giving, which was that phone call, which now here we are.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me on my 100th episode. And thanks for having me on Tech Bites. I'm excited to talk about tech and old tech.
Ancient tech, the OG tech, the first tech. But before we get to the old tech, we're going to start off with some new tech, like we always do, talking about apps we love, apps we've just discovered, apps that we hate because they're tracking us and sharing all of our personal information and are hitting delete, delete, delete. Maybe. Standing in today for the part of David Tatasciore is Victor Hirsch, who's our engineer today.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good.
It's nice to see you.
Good to see you too.
Early morning start today.
Yeah. Oh, I like mornings.
Yeah? Yeah. It's nice when it's quiet in the studio. We're actually, for those of you listening, we are the first show of the day on Thursdays, which is nice. So we get the fresh studio.
And the dining room is empty. So during my show, which is at 1 o'clock, you're looking out into the dining room at Roberta's and it's chock full of people. And sometimes once in a while, I'll get someone really loud at the table right by the window. And you can sometimes hear them on my show.
Well, they turn the music on at 11 because that's when the doors open. The restaurant is closed. They open the doors at 11. They turn the music on. So that's, you know, what you can hear in the background there.
So pizza for breakfast is only if it's cold pizza from the night before? Is that a thing? Or could you have like fresh pizza for breakfast?
I think you can have pizza whenever you want.
Okay.
Breakfast included, fresh or not fresh. I don't think that you could get a pizza right at 11 from the dining room kitchen. But what you can do is just two doors down from the restaurant is the Roberta's to go outpost where you can get fresh hot pizza for breakfast, no problem.
Pizza all day, every day.
Exactly. Although I'm 3 years in on my show. This is episode 132.
Awesome.
For those of you listening in the future. So I've had my fill of pizza over the years.
Same.
Yeah. So Vitor, do you have an app for us this week?
Yeah. Lynda.com is a really cool website. It started sounding like an ad just now. But basically, I love the website for... it's a tutorial workshop, online video thing that you can learn software. And for what I do, audio, video stuff, it's really cool because they have a bunch of different software that you can learn, editing, mixing, whatever you want. And they have an app, the Lynda app, which is spelled L-Y-N-D-A. And it's pretty cool because you can access... Well, you do need to have an account. I was lucky to have one through school, through NYU, that I think is lasting a bit longer after graduation. So that's cool. But I'm not sure what the subscription process is, but you do have to have one. But it's cool. You can access it on your phone, and it's pretty nice.
Excellent. We like things that are educational and that you can take with you, because we spend a lot of time just kind of sitting around doing nothing sometimes. So it's good to have stuff to be productive and engaged. Harry, do you have an app that you use all the time or that you love?
You know, nothing comes to mind immediately. I guess what I would say, one of the most useful apps that I have on my phone that I use all the time, and it's going to be boring, like it's not social media related and it's not
tech,
it's not savvy.
You'd be surprised how many efficiency and document scanning and that kind of stuff we have on the show.
So I have an app that does conversions.
Oh.
Volume conversions and length conversions, temperature conversions, all that kind of stuff.
So metric to empirical, that kind of thing?
All of that. And I absolutely love it. And I feel like that is one of the most useful apps. I also would say that the camera app on my phone is also one of the most useful.
What's the name of your conversion app?
I have to look which one I use. I think it's called Unit Converter.
Unit Converter, and is it free?
It is free.
Okay.
And it has a lot, looking through, it does pressure, force, power, angle, data, fuel, cooking, it has temperature, currency, time,
wow,
speed, length, area, weight, volume. So it really...
Does it have clothing sizes? Shoe sizes?
You know, I don't know if it has clothing sizes. That's one I had to look up recently, though.
Oh,
and I don't think
okay.
I turned to the app for it because I didn't even think about that. It may, indeed, but it has, if you look at it, it has temperature in units that I don't even know what they are. You know, I don't know what degrees are means.
Hmm.
I don't remember high school physics enough to remember what that temperature is.
I could only probably name three, like Celsius, Fahrenheit, Kelvin.
Yeah, those are there, and then there's two more.
Two more.
I don't know what they are. So it turns out that 30 degrees Celsius is 545.67 degrees R.
R.
Whatever that is. I don't know what that is. I'll have to look it up.
Roberta's.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But yeah, so that's one that I find myself using a lot. I guess another one, I've been trying to learn Japanese.
Okay.
And I've taken
that's
a couple
fun.
Of Japanese classes, and there's a great app called Lingo Deer.
Okay.
That is a language app.
D-E-E-R?
Yes.
Duolingo is also a language learning app that we've had several shout outs over the years.
Cool. So, it's one of those ones. Lingo Deer, I think, is specifically Japanese. It's one of those things that I try to remember that I have it on my phone, like when I'm, on the train or whatever. But I, often get trapped in the like, oh, what did so-and-so post on Instagram? And so I just end up looking at that. And then 5 minutes left in my ride, I'm like, oh, I should have been learning Japanese instead of looking at another picture of avocado toast.
Well, maybe you can have Akiko, who is the host of Japan Eats, be a Japanese tutor for you.
Yes, I've luckily, I mean, you know, the Japanese, Akiko included, you know, as a people, I feel like are very hospitable. So everyone I know who's Japanese, when I use my tiny bit of Japanese knowledge, they say, "Oh, your Japanese is really great. I'd be happy to tutor you." So I feel like I just need to get to
wonderful
start that.
Say something in Japanese.
Konnichiwa, watashi wa Harry desu. Dozo yoroshiku onegaishimasu.
Excellent. Hello, my name is Harry.
And dozo yoroshiku onegaishimasu is the sort of formal greeting that you give someone when you're meeting them for the first time. And it my understanding is it loosely translates into, you know, I look forward to, you know, working with you and knowing you and sort of being friends
with
you.
Very nice. Very formal.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So my apps today, I read a great article online on wired.com. And it was an article about if you are going to delete Facebook, which many people are talking about it or hashtagging about it on social media and in life. I don't know how many people will actually delete Facebook.
Right.
But if you're thinking about deleting Facebook, it was a very good article. It talked about the suite of apps you could turn to replicate the activities you do on Facebook, ranging from news feeds to connecting with people. And one of the ones that I thought was most interesting and also the most useful in a general sort of securing your privacy as much as possible online and securing your accounts. One of the reasons why Facebook just has such a deep, deep hook into all of our personal data is because many of the apps are built on top of Facebook or using Facebook, so many people will sign into new apps using their Facebook login because they don't want to take the time to create a new email set, you know, a new profile, a new
password
and all those kinds of things. It's just too cumbersome, and app developers know this, so that's the easy turnkey. And in some instances, it's meant to be helpful, and in some instances, it's very nefarious. So the things, the two apps that I thought were most helpful, and they're actually apps that we've talked about before, and we've done a few episodes on online security and personal security and the terms of agreement for apps, so we can, it might be nice to check back in on some of those. There are two apps. One is called 1Password, and the other app is called LastPass, and they are basically apps that create, save, and engage your passwords for you so you don't have to memorize them, so you don't have to have a million pieces of paper everywhere. And it will also help you, you know, generate them in some instances so you can come up with something that's actually, you know, longer and more complicated than, you know, Sushi One or, you know, Roberta's Pizza exclamation point.
Right.
Tech Bytes.
Yeah.
So 1Password and LastPass. The article was on Wired. It's apps to replace Facebook. It was really a good one. If you're thinking about deleting or you have deleted and you want to pick up, you know, some new apps to replace all those things, it's a great article to check out. So on to the show. Again, as I said at the top, this show comes out of a conversation that Harry and I had on his 100th episode of Feast Your Ears back on March 7th. And he asked the question of what I thought the first, you know, piece of food tech was and what the first piece of technology was. And we had a very short but exciting conversation. I said fire, because cooking, you know, with heat, with fire, was probably the greatest, you know, hurdle forward in terms of cooking. Although I don't know that fire was actually an invention. Maybe it's actually just the skill of harnessing fire and heat to cook with. Harry responded with the knife as the original piece of food tech, which is interesting to consider. And it's also interesting to consider when we think about technology today, we think about, you know, Wi-Fi connected refrigerators and, you know, reservation apps and, you know, social media and all those kinds of things. But, you know, what technology is and what is perceived as new technology is very subjective and very much a consideration of what your contemporary world is like. So, you know, we always focus on new tech, but I thought it would be really interesting to take a pause and focus on the old original tech and then have a discussion also about at what point does new tech become so utilized by the world and become so commonplace that it evolves out of being new tech and just becomes simply a part of the way we live and the tools of our life. So Harry's answer of the original, most ancient, most oldest OG food tech as being the knife, I think is a good argument.
I think that obviously there's a lot of things and there's no, you know, people like there to be a black and a white and a yes and no answer and for it to be very binary. Fire, obviously super important. I mean, on that show, I mentioned Richard Wrangham's book, Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human, which really makes the case that having cooked food is what allowed early man's brain to get bigger and allowed us access to all these nutrients that you can't get if you just are chewing on raw meat and roots and, you know, nuts and stuff. So that I think is really valid, but the knife I think comes into play, because you have this sort of across every culture and throughout modern, you know, modern human history, the need to cut things up in order to make them small enough to put in your mouth.
Or even to make it smaller to drag it along with you or, sure, you know, put it into some sort of rucksack. So I think you can be pretty definitive if you can put a stake in the ground at a certain point in time and be the oldest thing.
Sure. I mean, so, the oldest knife-like tool,
right?
Was found by the Leakeys in Olduvai Gorge in Africa and was dated. It was, you know, it was a stone, a human-formed piece of sharp stone that dates back 2.5 million years.
So 2.5 million years, and when we say knife, we're expanding the definition of, you know, the metal thing, which is a whole other segment and subset of technological advancements. But the first cutting object or cutting stone that was fabricated in order to do that is 2.5 million years ago.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that predates that in terms of, I'm using air quotes that you can't see on the radio, technology, food tech?
You know, I mean, I think it'd be hard to make a case that there's anything older than that, because that really, you know, when man started making tools, what were those early tools, right? They were likely for things like cutting or, you know, to make spears and arrows and, you know.
Would we consider a carrying vessel to be food technology or no? Like a carrying vessel, if you were, a bowl or some sort of sack or, you know, hide to carry water, ingredients, something, mixing.
I guess there is something technological there if it is something that is not just being found, right? So you're not just taking a dry gourd and using it as a vessel, but you're actually taking clay, say, and forming something. I would be willing to make the case that is also technology.
Okay. I wonder if that predates a cutting stone.
I don't know. I would say that the cutting stone, at least as someone who works with knives and, you know, talks a lot about knives and, you know, sort of thinks about them, I would say that the knife is more important because I think you could survive without making those other things. But I think you need a knife.
To survive.
Yeah.
So we think of the knife in terms of really, most of us, we'll think of the knife as something that you use to cut food into smaller pieces. But I think if we go back 2.5 million years ago, they were probably also using it to, much like a butcher would today,
sure,
utilizing a knife to cut a giant thing that's, you know, potentially a few times bigger than yourself.
Yep.
Down to a smaller, more manageable size, even for storage and transportation.
Yeah. And for harvest, too. I mean, I think we have to remember that even with foraging and things, like, there still was probably a need to cut things off of trees or off, you know, to cut plants as well.
So one of the things that I'm just fascinated by is at what point do you think that the cutting stone ceased to be a marvel and just became what everybody had? You know, a cutting stone in every hand.
Right.
Before the precursor to the chicken in every pot.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I have to imagine that at a certain point, you know, I mean, obviously there's like, you know, patient zero or whatever, like there's the first person who realized they could knock two stones together, but that's kind of a, you know, it's impossible for us to trace that far back. As someone who's not, I'm not an archaeologist, I don't know where in the timeline these things become prevalent all over the place, but I think it can't have taken that long. Right. I mean, as humans developed and as early man developed and spread out, the fact that you do find the knife in every kitchen or in every food preparation worldwide, where you don't necessarily have a fork,
even as a worldwide. You even have it worldwide very commonly as, you know, the pocket knife or the Swiss Army knife or the utility tool. That's even outside of a cooking environment where you would just have it for, you know, all those other types of cutting in different situations that you might need. So it's a fairly ubiquitous thing. I think one of the other points that we talked about on the timeline of evolving tech, and we all know that tech evolves, you can have a great idea and then a better version comes along, you know, 18 months later and you have to buy the new one.
Yep.
At what point did we acquire metal knives? Because metal knives are really... I mean, a cutting stone is an amazing piece of technology that people really utilized what they had, but then the metal knife is harnessing the fire with the steel.
And and with an element that's then being turned into something else and manufactured. My understanding is about 4,000 years ago, the first copper knives appeared and making them out of metal. And then, you know, fast forward to the modern age, and most knives are made of steel. I mean, we have ceramic knives now in the last 15, 20 years or so, as a sort of new material that, you know, is marketed for having all these antimicrobial, antibacterial, never rusts properties.
They can chip, though.
Yes, they can. They're much harder.
But they're very, we have a lot of ceramic knives at home. And they're easy to transport, and they're actually very pleasant to work with.
Yeah, yeah, they are. You know, and I think that it's still a knife, right? You don't think of it as a different piece of technology than a chef's knife that's made of steel.
And we don't think of the plastic picnic knife or the thing that you get in a to-go box to be, even though we know it's different, it's still in the same category of knife.
Right, yeah, because you're using it to cut things into smaller pieces.
And you know, the plastic knife was even significant enough to be banned on airlines for quite some time after 9/11, at least in the United States. You couldn't bring those plastic knives onto a plane, and they didn't have them anymore when you got your in-flight meal service.
Yeah, but if you were my mother, you could bring your knitting needles on the plane.
Right, well, that's your mom. That's your mom.
She was a dangerous lady. Come on.
That's a different show, Harry. Harry's Mom is Dangerous is a totally different show. Right now, we're going to have to take a quick break from this show, Tech Bites, which is one of 35 shows live every week on the Heritage Radio Network. And we make all that great radio entirely out of the generosity and sponsorship of our members, grants, and amazing underwriters like this one. Stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
Well, if you're just joining us and you're wondering what the hell you clicked on, this is Tech Bites, the weekly show where we talk about the intersection of food and technology. We talk about software platforms, apps, digital tech, cooking tech. Do you have a piece of tech you want us to talk about? Are you a founder of a new company and you think you would be a great CEO conversation? Get in touch with us. We would love to hear from you. We are very interactive. You can find us on social media at Tech Bites, BITESHRN. on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or you can send us an email, techbytes@heritageradionetwork.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today, we are hearing from Harry Rosenblum, who is the host of Feast Your Ears, which is another great heritage show. He's on every Wednesday at 1 p.m. And his show is it's conversations with people about food from all different professions and places and points of view. And I really enjoy listening to his show. And I'm also a little bit envious of Harry and his show, because while I love the super specificity of Tech Bytes and really, you know, digging deep and sometimes getting a little geeky on the tech, sometimes I come across guests that I would love to talk to and love to have on the show, but they're just not techie. And Harry, because his show is about people's, you know, lives through the lens of food, you can talk to anybody.
I can. I mean, I feel like I'm very lucky in that regard. And it also makes, it's one of the things that I like about my show, is that, you know, it could be a man on the street, or it could be, you know, a famous chef.
Or one of my favorite episodes is you have an airline pilot.
Yes.
Also,
yes,
which was great.
Yeah, that was a fun one to do. My goal, I mean, if I had like a dream guest for my show, it would be to talk to an astronaut on the space station.
Okay. You could probably get a chef who makes food for the astronauts.
Oh, yeah. True.
I actually got to have one of my dream guests on. One of my dream guests was Nathan Myhrvold, who's Modernist Cuisine. And if you are in the food/cooking/tech world, you will know his name and also his exhaustively excessive and really fascinating tomes on cooking and bread. And I got to have him on last summer on the release of his book, Modernist Bread, that dovetailed with the series that we did called Modernist Breadcrumbs.
That's a great story and a great series.
Yeah, he's fascinating. And, you know, he was a great conversation in that we talked quite a bit about the history of these different food technologies, because his book was all about bread, but back in the day, and when we say back in the day, we're talking, you know, 23, you know, million years ago or something. the first, you know, bread baking, and we're talking about, you know, bakeries in Pompeii and things like that. So the fascinating thing to me about that, I mean, aside from the obvious that it's 2,500 pages about bread, is that following and studying the history of bread, and on this show, the history of knives, you're really following the history of civilization.
Yep.
In many ways.
For
and
sure.
I think one of the most interesting things that Harry and I talked about, we started talking a little bit about the Japanese knife industry. And if you are a chef or a cooking aficionado, you will know that Japanese knives are the holy grail, super it bag, superstar of all knives. They are the Rolls Royce best in class things to have. And part of the reason why is that they're made by hand in the tradition of the samurai swords.
Yeah, they are. So, I mean, the Japanese knife industry really was a blade industry dating back all the way to, you know, the 10th century or so, even a little bit before that when the bladesmithing started in Japan, and continued really as an industry to make swords until the middle of the 19th century.
They didn't need swords quite so much.
Well, and the emperor of Japan outlawed the samurai. So essentially it also became the makers had no market. They didn't have anybody to buy their blades.
Because Ronin.
Yeah, exactly. And so a
so
number...
they had to stop making swords. Do something else.
Yeah.
And so they just made smaller swords.
Yeah. And which they were already making. I mean, they were already making those, but they really focused their business. So I work with a company called Kikuichi Cutlery, who are the oldest knife company in the world. The company traces its heritage back to 1267, when the current owner's family ancestor was a sword maker for the Emperor of Japan.
That's amazing. So I know we're on radio and you can't see them, but if you look at the website for the knife company that he's talking about, Kikuichi, yep, is kikuchi.com.
Kikuichi.
Oh.
www.japanesefoods.com.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if you can go to .com, we'll lead you to the Japanese site, which does have some English translation. And if you go to .net, that's sort of the American side of the company's site.
So one of the things that is so beautiful about the Japanese knives, and now many other knife makers use the same practice slash technology, is it's damask steel. So explain to us what that is, because it's part of what makes them so good, but also visually what makes them so beautiful.
Yeah, so when you have Damascus steel, you have these layers of steel, and originally that was done in the making of swords by folding the piece of steel. So you're heating it in a forge, and you're folding it over, and you're making a layer, and you're hammering that out thinner.
Like puff pastry or croissant.
Totally, absolutely. It's a very
when
similar
process.
When
you're like process.
Laminating dough. Yep, just hotter and a little harder, and you don't need a hammer if you're making croissant. So, you know, and what that yields by doing that is it yields strength in the steel. Historically, you know, steel is an alloy of iron, which is a very soft element. And then with the addition of carbon and other things, you get different kinds of steel, ultimately yielding in the 20th century the invention, creation of lots of stainless steel, because we were afraid of rust and patina on our steel. Or on our knives and on other
and
things.
And when you say we, you mean Americans?
Or to a certain extent, I mean, yes. I mean, stainless steel had other uses.
People.
I mean, stainless steel doesn't corrode. So it was being used in the shipping industry and being used in aerospace and things like that. But it wasn't really until the 1970s and 80s that the cost of that alloy came down enough that it made sense to make things like a kitchen knife that a regular consumer would buy. Out of those metals. But historically, with that carbon steel, it had to be heated and folded and heated and folded, and then would be heat treated to sort of maintain that hard edge. And what that does yield is this beautiful patterning on the knife because of the multiple layers.
It looks like waves or lace sometimes, it also looks a little bit like a topographical map.
Sure.
The way it sort of has the, you know, it's following itself.
Yep.
One of the other unique characteristics about the Japanese knives are they're only bladed on one side.
Correct, yeah. So traditionally they have a single bevel. So the way I often describe that to people is that in the modern day they're more like a razor blade, whereas a Western-style chef's knife is more like, if you look at the profile, it's like a V. And so you're sharpened evenly on both sides. And traditionally, Japanese blades, swords were sharpened on both sides, but kitchen knives were sharpened, or other, you know, industrial-style knives were only sharpened on one side and had a single bevel. And that has to do with the way the knives are used, and I'm not sure whether the way the knife is held and used to cut came from the form or vice versa.
So I have a limited knowledge about the Japanese knife thing. My husband's a chef and has a very nice collection of Japanese knives and has been collecting them for quite some time. Has things that he's just bought in shops in Japan and also things that have been custom made.
Yep.
My understanding is that the length of the blade has to do with the cut that it makes because of the... So back to the Western knife where the blade is like a V shape. You can kind of go chop up and down like that movement that we all know when you're chopping onions or something like that. Or you would maybe make one cut and pull it through or do all different kinds. Very versatile usage in terms of the types of chopping and motions that you're going to make. With the Japanese knife, because it's only bladed on one side, you're not going to do that sort of up and down chopping motion. You're going to put the blade onto the item to cut, and then you're going to pull the blade through to the end of the blade. So if you look at the knives that are made for filleting fish, they are very long and very thin because you would start the cut at the base of the blade and then pull the blade all the way through along the length of the fish, give you a long cut. If you look at the knives that are made for cutting bone or vegetables, they're typically very short.
By comparison,
By comparison, because you're going to make one quick, hard, short chop.
Yeah, so, I mean, the other big difference, I think, is that, you know, you mentioned the Western blade where we're used to chopping up and down, and we're sort of all taught, like, the claw grip with the opposite hand. Your fingers are never near the sharp edge of the blade. Like, that's the first thing you're taught, right, when you're taught knife skills in the West. If you go, and the best place for sort of, anyone to see this is if you go to a sushi restaurant, and you watch the chef slicing pieces of fish to make sushi, they are always putting their hand on the fish, their fingers, and they're in fact slicing towards the hand.
Yes.
And that is something that we never ever do here at all. But part of that has to do with the control and their technique and also the sharpness of the blade. But if you think about it, if you're holding a knife in your right hand that is essentially flat on the side of the blade that's facing up, and you are cutting towards your hand, and that bevel is going to lead that blade towards the board. It's not going to lead it into the middle of your fingers. And so that's another, it's a different technique that you use for using that blade.
Yeah, it's a very, very different cutting style in the way you hold the knives. Yep. I've also heard many chefs and people who use Japanese knives say that if you're using them properly, because the blades themselves are built to, guide the blades through the product in a specific way, it requires a lot less force and strength, and that holding them is much more delicate and relaxed, and you just sort of pull the blade through the item that you're cutting, and the blade kind of does a lot of the work for you. Whereas with many of the Western knives, it's when I go back to that kind of up and down chopping motion, that's all like arm and shoulder. Yeah. And there's, if you're, using a knife and you're on your feet cutting food, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day, the Japanese knives are purportedly much more relaxing and easier and kind of better to use if you're using them in the proper way.
Yeah, and I think that that's true. And I think that there's a certain aspect of that that has to also do with sharpness. So, and it gets back to the knife being this tool. And the whole point of a tool, right, is to make the work easier for us as humans.
Right.
And so if you're thinking about a knife as an important tool, it's supposed to make cutting the food easier, not harder. And so when you start to realize that, it's really taking me a lot of force to get through that carrot, well, that means more than likely your knife is dull.
So we are still very much involved in the technology of fabrication of the knives in terms of which one you pick, which one you use, how it's made. But then also you have to engage a little bit in the technology actually yourself in terms of sharpening and maintenance.
Absolutely. And I think that, So coming sort of forward into the technology of the steel knife and of the metal blade, as I mentioned, all knives were made of a carbon steel, a much simpler kind of steel, until, about 30 years ago. And even in the last 10 years, there have been great advancements in the alloys and in the manufacturing of steel. So now you have what's called powdered steel, where there are very low impurities in the steel, where you can make a sheet of steel for cutting out knife blades, where the steel itself is incredibly uniform. It's uniform of thickness, it's uniform of grain, it's uniform of texture. And then you have alloys that allow for lots of different aspects of those blades. And as you change those around, you get different properties in your blade. Some of them make the blade wear better. Some of them make them stain resistant and rust resistant. Chromium, for instance. Some of them make them take a finer edge. So vanadium will help your blade take a finer grain, have a finer texture to the steel, which will take a finer edge, which people equate with being sharper.
So we have the original tech at 2.5 million years ago. And today we have subsets of the evolution of that technology into different things. Do you think people still consider the knife a piece of technology? We were talking just before the show about how the knife is something that probably is in use around the world, regardless of, culture, type of eating, cuisine, whether it's being used as a tool for life or as a tool for cooking. They're almost everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I to get back to your question about when does something go from being sort of considered technology to being just a piece of, a piece of life or an everyday object. I think that the knife is not considered a piece of technology by people. I think that people who are interested in knives and are following knife making and following knife, blade technology, do think of there are things that have happened.
Metal alloy of the month's club.
Exactly. I mean, in the metallurgy or in the manufacturing style, what it comes to mind for me is that I wonder, as we sit here in the studio, we both grew up before everyone had a camera in their pocket on their phone.
Yep.
But I look at my children and I think that, or even looking at other people. I mean, even myself, right? I don't think of that now. If I pull out my phone to use it, and the camera was the other thing I was going to say, I use all the time in my on my phone. It's not really an app. I guess it is an app, but, you know, to take pictures of documents that I need to send people or password, you know, a Wi-Fi password in a cafe. If I'm going to go sit down, I don't remember it. I take a picture of it.
Or things you want to remember. Oh, yeah. I want to read that book, yeah. Or that's a great painting, yep. Or there's the restaurant, or...
Yeah, or I'm going to post that on Instagram. Whatever it is, the thinking, you know, I definitely view my phone. I mean, I call it a phone, but it does so much more. I you know, my...
mini computer.
My brother calls it the tiny internet. my pocket computer, I view that as a piece of technology, but I don't view the camera piece of it as much as a piece of technology. Whereas, you know, when I was a kid, I had a Nikon, you know, camera that, you know, was a real, like, you know, SLR camera. And then I had a cheaper camera, and so those I could compare as different pieces of technology that used
Polaroid.
Film. I had a Polaroid, sure. So those to me felt like technology, but this doesn't.
It's very interesting. I think also about what things will become not technology going forward. And, you know, even things elementally, one of the things we were talking about are ingredients or, you know, things that are cooking technology, like cornstarch, for example. Was initially an industrial product that was used for starching laundry. It was a laundry starch. And it made its way into kitchens and was this like crazy powder. And now it's so ubiquitous that cornstarch, it's an ingredient like a banana.
Right. And it just appears in a list and you're just expected to have it in your cabinet.
Yeah.
Right. Or like baking powder. I mean, I think of, you know, I have a cookbook at home from Rizon, which was a very early baking powder. But, you know, baking powder was not something that was ubiquitous in the, you know, I mean, the book I think is from the, you know, teens, maybe the 1920s. And that wasn't ubiquitous, but now it is. Now, you know, if you're going to make anything at home, you know, that should be in your spice drawer, right?
Yep. Fascinating. Fascinating. At what point does something cease to be technology and just become a part of everyday life? And how do we define what technology is? I mean, it maybe depends on your experience and your frame of reference. You know, maybe people who don't have iPhones or smartphones or the, you know, pocket internet might see it, you know, 10 years from now and say, wow, that's an amazing piece of technology. Whereas for your kids, perhaps they would say, oh, yeah, it's just the thing.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about other kitchen technologies, right? And the fact that the refrigerator, at least in this country or the first world or whatever you want to call it, you know, the refrigerator is something that's accepted, right? If you would never move into an apartment and... If
not
it wasn't,
and
not have a refrigerator, mm-hmm. right? In the same way that you wouldn't move in and not have running water.
Right.
But those things are not necessarily available in other places in the world. And yet, you know, there are places without running water and without electricity in every home where they do have smartphones.
The internet.
Yeah, they do have the internet in their pocket.
Amazing. And then also even just in our lifetime, the microwave, the magic oven.
Yeah.
I mean, that was something that, you know, came into being and became, you know, average home item.
Well, and the people were scared of.
Yes.
I mean,
still are a little bit.
And, you know, I mean, I remember you go into a restaurant.
Don't put metal in it.
Except that someone recently told me that there was at the houseware show in Chicago a few weeks ago, there was a metal, like grilled cheese press that has some kind of coating on it and you put it in the microwave.
Oh my gosh.
And that, I mean, I said, what do you mean? I thought you weren't supposed to put metal in the microwave.
Well, there is that sort of metallic coating that's the plastic sleeve box that you put like a Hot Pocket into and then it makes the Hot Pocket crispy.
Hmm.
Which I've seen on TV, not at home. Just to be clear, for the record, we do not have a microwave at home.
I don't either.
There are no Hot Pockets.
We have a tiny, like 3/4 quart Le Creuset saucepan that we call the microwave.
Oh, okay.
Because I find that if you're reheating leftovers, a little bit of water in that pan on the stove will reheat the leftovers just as fast as a microwave.
We make toast in a saute pan.
Yeah.
Well, that is all the time that we have for the show today. Before we say goodbye, I want to call out some real-life events that you can connect with the HRN crew and connect with Tech Bytes. We have a Heritage Radio Network member happy hour coming up next week. Are you a member of Heritage Radio? If you're not, it's time to get on it. It will take place on Tuesday, April 3rd from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Harbor Bar, which is inside the Whole Foods Market at Bryant Park, and our very own DJ Cherish the Love, Cynthia Maloran, who hosts Wedding Cake. We'll be spinning tunes, and HRN members will get 2 tokens, both good for a free beer. Look for the HRN table when you get to the Harbor Bar to check in and get your beer tokens. And if you're not a member but want to become a member, I think they can help you out on the spot as
well. And I bet
well.
If you sign up on the spot, you get 2 beers. So
you definitely do, which is better than the t-shirt. Almost. The other real life event that we are getting ready for is we are doing a live pitch show on Tech Bytes on April 19th. If you listened to episode 123 of Tech Bytes, which was about VC funding in the food tech space, we had Charlie O'Donnell, who's the founder of Brooklyn Bridge Ventures, which is Brooklyn's only venture capital group. He is going to be coming back on the show on Thursday, April 19th, and we will have 2 companies who will have the opportunity to pitch him live on the show.
That is really cool.
This is real. This is like Tech Byte Shark Tank kind of thing happening. I'm very excited about it. It's the first time we're going to do something like this. It should be great. So how can you occupy one of those 2 seats? Well, you have to be New York City based. You have to be available to be in studio on the 19th for the show live at 11. And you also have to be pre-$750,000 funding stage and send the pitch deck. Send your pitch deck. Tell us why you have a great product and a great company. Tell us why your team is particularly adept and superstars at this project and where you are in your company's life and your funding. Again, you can email us techbytes@heritageradionetwork.org. So lots of great things, lots of great ways to really connect in the real world with Heritage Radio, because at the end of the day, that's really what technology is good for, mostly. Technology is good for finding the really delicious things in real life. I want to thank Harry Rosenblum, host of Feast Your Ears, for coming on the show. If you want to follow him, he is at The Food Baller on Instagram. He is also at the Brooklyn Kitchen, which you may have heard of. It's a little cooking shop event education space in Brooklyn that has been a longtime supporter of Heritage Radio and a longtime fixture in the Brooklyn culinary world. They are at the BKLYN Kitchen. And if you want to find out more about the supersonic Japanese knives, they are at KIKIUCHI.cutlery on social media. Or KIKIUICHI.com. Whew, that's all the time we have. I'm Jennifer Leuzzi, host and producer of Tech Bytes. Tech Bytes is engineered today by Vitor Hirsch. Our theme song is Nomad, a CPU track by DJ Uptown Nico. We broadcast live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time from the Heritage Radio Network studio inside Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. Come back and see us next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or and how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.